You're listening to a message from Oaks Church Brooklyn. Our longing is to see heaven come to earth in our city. For more information on our church and community, please visit oaksbk.church.
Today's text is a paraphrase from Exodus 12 through 19. 430 years and a new day has dawned. Egypt is home of the past. The children of Israel now journey ahead to their promised one. Rescued by God through the staff of Moses, wonders and miracles abound. The sea is split, the oppressor defeated, a captive people is free. They'll be singing the song of deliverance to the generations to come. Clouds by day, fire by night, food from heaven, water from a rock. God's mysterious provision continues. But they are disgruntled people, doubtful of what lies ahead. Yet God is with these wilderness wanderers, eager to meet them at Sinai. This is the story of God.
Good morning. As Patrick mentioned, if I haven't met you, my name is Tina. I'm one of the elders here at Oaks, and it's a privilege to be here today to go through the next part of the story that we're in the book of Exodus. So as we've been following in the story of God, we've also been doing this in our community group, and so when I told them that I would be speaking today, they suggested I walk out to When You Believe, the Whitney and Mariah version. I didn't do it, but I just wanted to acknowledge this great idea. And I myself am partial to the original version, or one of the older versions of this story in the movie The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston from 1956. And I just watched a clip of it yesterday. It's pretty, that was the time before CGI, let's just put it that way. Now, fun fact, and this has nothing to do with anything we're really talking about today, but I didn't know this, there is a 1923 version of The Ten Commandments that Cecil B. DeMille also did. And I've never watched it, so I will maybe be doing a viewing party, but just telling you that, and I digress. So back to the text. For those of you who are new or visiting, we are currently in a series of the story of God, and we've been traveling, journeying with the people of Israel. We started in Genesis before they were even a people, and now we're in Exodus. And we're in a very good part of the story. I feel very privileged to get to tell this part today. Last week, where Ryan left us off is in Exodus 12. The people of Israel finally leave Egypt after the Passover. This is after over 400 years in the land of Egypt, where God has told, you know, it was prophesied to Abraham years prior that they would have this time in Egypt, they would be enslaved, and then they would be freed. And so after the 10th and most tragic plague, the death of the firstborns, Pharaoh, who has been hardened towards the, you know, the request of Moses and God's request to have the people worship him, finally lets the people of Israel go to worship. Now, there's a complexity, obviously, to the story. Last week's Q&A definitely was very interesting. I thought a lot about the questions that were brought up, and there's lots to sit with here. But just kind of a like side note, I can't encourage us enough to wrestle as we like go through the text together. I think it's so good to like sit with it and see what God might be revealing about himself in that time, and as we as modern people look at it, what God might be actually saying about himself to us. And so here in the sparing of the Israelites in last week's series message, they are now a free people, so to speak. And we enter back into their story as they flee Egypt. So I don't know if you know the number of people that were, you know, kind of estimated to have left, but the text says it's about 600,000 men, not including women, not including children, and not including livestock. So that's a lot of people hurrying out of a country that they had been in for, you know, hundreds of years. By the hand of Yahweh, this is, you know, they're being led by their deliverer, Moses, and this is quite the sight. As they were leaving, I can only imagine what they may have been experiencing, and we'll go a little bit more into that. But for those of us who have heard, like, the story of Moses, he was part of the Egyptian court, a man of privilege, runs away, a desert wanderer, and then comes back to free the people. But the people he's freeing and leading out of Egypt, they have no context for any other life except that which is of Egypt. And so, as I've been sitting with this text, I've wondered so much, what was actually happening for them? What were they feeling? What were they thinking? What were they experiencing in their bodies as they were running, taking their stuff, bringing their livestock, making sure their children weren't, you know, disappearing on the road out of Egypt? So we are going to follow them today through the next steps of this journey. I definitely think there's a sense of, like, collective trauma that they probably were experiencing as a people. And to be honest, the only way I can even imagine that for, like, a little bit is to, like, say the harken back to this time 4 years ago, and I think of 2020. If I say that year, it immediately conjures up some memory of pandemic, confinement, global tragedy, something unprecedented, a lifetime event that shapes and mars for many years to come. And I'm not comparing the exodus of the Israelites to the pandemic at all. And I'm also not discounting that, you know, there were positive outcomes for people in the midst of that difficult time. But there is an undeniable human suffering and shaping that happens when there is collective trauma. And so, kind of reaching into that experience, I put myself in their shoes, and I invite you to imagine what it was like for these people as they were journeying out of Egypt. They are far removed in time from their ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, who was in Egypt. And I think of the astonishment of these people navigating, leaving, but being unsure of what's ahead. So here we are, our teaching text begins sort of in chapter 13, coming out of Egypt, where God asks them to consecrate their firstborn males. So remember, just a little bit ago, the firstborns of Egypt's households were, you know, tragically dead, you know, as a part of the final plague. And what happened in the Passover is really interesting because the plague would have fallen on everybody except that there was the blood that was over the doorpost that, you know, spared the lives of those who were not, you know, who were able to be covered by that blood. And so God is inviting those people who have come out of that plague to now consecrate those firstborns that were spared, the firstborn males, the animals, the livestock, as humans and livestock. And so something is really interesting here. This is a tradition that God tells them to now hold for years to come, an observance. And this newly liberated people are introduced to a remembrance of what God had done for them at that time during Passover. Now these people, they're on the move. They have been concentrated in one place for their whole lives, really, in Goshen, in Egypt. And the only movement they might have had is if they had to go build something in a certain spot, but they weren't going out to brunch or anything like that, you know? They didn't have freedom of and mobility the way that, you know, us who are free have. And so now these wanderers are desert bound. They're free from servitude. They're being led to worship Yahweh as promised at his holy mountain. But remember in 2020 or 2021 when you finally got to like leave your home and see people? What did that feel like? It was probably joyful, but also scary. And so this could be somewhat of the posture they're in, unsure of what's ahead. So now they're headed to this mountain that Moses is taking them to. It's known as Horeb, or Sinai, as more are familiar with probably. But this is the location that, if we rewind, Moses actually meets with God. And this is when he's in the desert himself, he gets his calling from God. And God actually tells Moses, hey, Moses, you are going to come back to this mountain with these people. And so this is a very interesting experience collectively for the people of Israel, but it also is probably kind of astonishing for Moses, who now is actually going back with these people. Like, God really has made good on his promise. So what a time for them to be alive. Now, you think after the plagues, after leaving Egypt, things would be easy. They would go to Sinai, and then they would make their way to Canaan, the promised land, but it's not easy. It's not the case at all. There are twists and there are turns, and things don't settle down a bit. If I was a tour guide at a Universal Studios immersive experience of the Book of Exodus, I would say, buckle up. Things are going to get a lot wilder. So I think the text is on the screen. We're going to look at Exodus 13, verses 17 to 22. I'll just kind of skim it a little bit, but in verse 17, I want to draw our attention to something. It says, when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around the desert road toward the Red Sea. I think we all know what's going to happen next. So the Israelites went up out of Egypt ready for battle, but let's see what really happens. So the next verses go on to tell us that the bones of Joseph were brought out of Egypt, which was, again, a promise that was made to Joseph. So they're bringing this generational mandate to life. So they leave the place that they're camped in, Succoth. Then they camp at another place called Etham, which is on the edge of the desert near the Red Sea. And God is mysteriously providing for them, like GPS style. There is a cloud of fire in the daytime to kind of direct them where to go. And there is a pillar of cloud, to direct them in the daytime, and then a pillar of fire at the nighttime. And this is how they figure out where they're to go next. So as I read in verse 17, super interesting, God does not lead them the easy way, ouch, or the shorter way, double ouch. God works counterintuitively, leading them the longer way, knowing probably what war might ensue. He's concerned for the people of Israel, wanting them to not give up so quickly and easily, and then want to go back to their bondage. So while the Israelites presume fighting is par for the course, they're ready, they're going to do this, God actually knows what's happening at a deeper level, and he knows, I don't know if they're going to really hang in there. So he intervenes. So by the pillar of, you know, cloud by day, the pillar of fire by night, he leads them. They don't know where they're going. I mean, they're in the middle of a desert. I mean, sometimes I don't know where I'm going when I'm on the subway. You know, like, they are being led somewhere they don't know. They've never been this way before. And even their leader, Moses, has been in the desert. He was living there. But even he probably isn't able to navigate through the sand and storms of the desert with almost a million people probably. So now this backtracking that's happening, right? You know, they're supposed to go the short way. Well, Pharaoh's folks have eyes on this. And he, Pharaoh, who has been conquered, so to speak, is now stewing. He is really angry about the economic impact of letting these people go. It's an entire workforce that is no longer his. So his heart is hardened again, despite everything that's happened. 10 plagues, loss of life, his people suffering, but he doesn't care. He wants these people back. So he changes his mind again and decides to go after the people of Israel. And now he's seeing this confusion in their travels as an opportunity. He's going to seize it, and he's going to get them back. But once again, just like in the plagues, where God brought confusion, and even though the magicians of Egypt could emulate the same types of plagues, they couldn't remove the plague. So here, God will not be outsmarted by Pharaoh. So now imagine with me the people of Israel, back to the immersive ride over here. The liberation, elation, what I call it, is starting to diminish, and they realize what is happening. They see the Egyptian army, and they are panicking. They are trapped by a sea ahead of them. And they are mad, and they are scared, and they are crying out to God, and they're cursing Moses. They're complaining to him. They're saying it would have been better for us to stay in Egypt and be slaves than to die in this desert. What have you done, Moses? Why have you brought us here? Why couldn't you just have left us alone? But God was just getting started, and this is the backdrop for one of the most, you know, monumental scenes, maybe, arguably, in the Old Testament. In chapter 14, verse 21, it says, "Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and a wall of water on their left." And thanks to, like, Hollywood CGI, I don't need to help you visualize that in a ton of detail, but I mean, that is a marvel to imagine walking through dry ground. Let's say this was the stretch where they were. There's water just like piling on this side and kept back on this side. And these people who were brought out of Egypt only to be chased back by the ruler of Egypt are now walking through dry ground. And they just want to survive, but like, this is a lot of information for them to take, and they just go with the dry ground. So what's super interesting in verse 14, that it says that with a strong east wind. I don't think this is like a geographically descriptive, you know, term. The reason I say this, what I mean is, I don't know about the mechanics of this exactly, but the word wind, the east wind there, is actually the same word, ruha, that is used in Genesis 1. So I think if you were following in the series from Genesis, in the beginning, the Spirit of God hovered. That's the same word, ruha. And so this Spirit of God, so to speak, this wind orders the chaos that they find themselves in. So the miracle continues as they cross this dry ground. Moses raises his staff. The water comes back over the militia of Egypt, and they are swallowed into the sea. I'm not going to like deny the complexity again of plagues and people, you know, en masse being swallowed by water here. But what is really interesting is that, like a trauma survivor who probably has a sense of relief when their captor is like put into prison, these people now are breathing a sigh of relief that their oppressor can chase them no more. And so they continue on with singing and celebration. Now, coming out of that miracle that just happened, we find them going through the desert. And in fact, they're through the desert for about 3 days without water. And just like deserts are hot now, they were then too. So they're not happy. And they do find water. There is provision. But then this water that they like find after 3 days, it's bitter. Again, not happy. I mean, these are people that just saw like water part on sides, you know, walk through the dry ground, enemies, you know, defeated. But they see, they get water, it's bitter, and they're not happy. So then God provides again. He asks Moses actually to throw, you know, a piece of wood into the water. It becomes sweet. They drink it. Great. They're provided for. And then this pattern of desert journey and desert grumbling is now becoming cyclical. And later on in chapter 16, we find that the people of Israel in verse 2 say, if only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death. They are grumbling, ungrateful. And God meets them again. He says, I will rain down bread from heaven for you. And then he gives instructions for that. There's provision on a daily basis. And then there's a lot of nuance to this, a provision for 2 days for Sabbath. And all that to say, God is raining down bread for them and also quails at night to feed them through their desert journey, but he makes provision for them on a daily basis because these are people of survival. There are people who have been traumatized and they probably can't see beyond their immediate reality. And so God in his kindness, it feels, this Yahweh of Israel, who they don't really know, is meeting them in the day-to-day of their lives. He even gives them provision for Sabbath, rest. What is rest for a people who have been enslaved? Things to think about. So 3 months, or around approximately 3 months coming out of Egypt, the people of Israel make it to this mountain of the Lord. Despite their grumbling, despite the challenges that were real, God has provided for them. And they have arrived there. They have an invitation from the Lord to meet with him. So what will happen next? This is to be continued. as I've been sitting with this text, there's like two main thoughts that have been personal reflections for me. The first is in chapter 13, verse, I think 17, where God kind of takes them back instead of taking them the shorter way. It just really makes me think about the detours, the delays, and the sometimes backward feeling like guidance of God. And yet I see the sovereignty of God in knowing what they needed. There would be no Red Sea miracle if the delays didn't happen. And so I've been thinking about that a lot. Maybe you are too. The other thing I've been thinking about is this people of Israel who see God's provision, but their trust is so short-lived. They're unable to go beyond trusting just at the miracle. But perhaps, in my reflection, I think it has to do with not knowing Yahweh, this God of Israel, who isn't providing miracles for sustenance as much as he is to show them he is their provision. So as we move into a time of communion and prayer, the Exodus story is part of the Old Testament, foreshadowing the depiction of deliverance, salvation, sanctification, is a reminder, and of course we'll keep talking about this, but in Jesus, who we believe and follow, we are reminded of the recreation, the parting of the seas, the bringing out of Egypt spiritually, and the promise of the goodness of God. And so as we come to the table, I'm reminded of how that same God is Redeemer, miracle worker, and friend in our partaking of these elements. So, you know, I'm going to invite the team to... Oh, actually, I forgot, Q&A. I'll take one or two questions. We have a little time, if I dare. I'm gonna resort to a podcast if I don't want to answer this, but no. Ask the questions. Oh, there a question at the back? Yeah. Yes, that's correct. So the whole thing of Passover is that they were going to bypass the angel of death coming and taking the life of the firstborns by this blood of the lamb. I mean, it's, you know, very symbolic if we pull it through into what we understand of the sacrifice of Christ. But, you know, spoiler alert there. But yeah, the plague could have actually threatened all of them, but the Passover was about the mercy of not having that happen to them. And so, you know, then the consecration happens because, or the consecration rather is an invitation to be able to give back to God what he spared of theirs. Does that make sense? Any other questions? I'm going to actually see. We might have some questions here.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. I did look it up. I don't know, because here's the thing. We say Red Sea, but we don't actually know for sure. Like, archaeologists are like, we just don't know if it was what we know as the modern Red Sea, and which, even if it was, like, okay, what portion of it, but the translation is Sea of Reeds, so it's kind of in that general area, but we don't know. I don't know the depth of what it might have been. And then it's like, you know, how stretched was it? Was the pillar, like, I mean, the wall, like, wide, or was it deep, or I don't know. So I wish I knew. This maybe this is where the CGI, what, you know, will help us imagine, but yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, it is. Oh. Oh, nice. Thank. Yeah. Don't even need Hollywood. Here we go. Any other questions? Actually, we have some here too. Ah, this is a good question. I'll do this. I think this will be a last one. What do you make of water being used as a tool for Yahweh's judgment? How would you relate this theme to Noah narrative and the flood? So that's maybe like can be explored further in the podcast perhaps, but there is something to be said about waters carried through the narrative of scripture. And exact like I think I mentioned earlier about Ruah, like the water, the Spirit of God coming and bringing order out of the chaos. So the water can be chaotic, but the alignment of it or the separation of it shows the order and the Creator God's like intervention in it. And so in terms of the Noah narrative and the flood, again, it's another picture of water being used, like there is water that has potential for chaos, but then in the correct marking of it, an order of it, there is life. So it's, you know, I'll let Ryan and Patrick handle more of this on the podcast, but that's an initial thought.